Hi, everyone. Welcome to the nonfiction keynote of the 15th annual Boston Book Festival. I'm Debbie Porter. I'm the founder of the Boston Book Festival, and I am delighted to see you here today. Thank you. Thank you. It's sort of a mob scene out there, right? I like it when a scholar and an author is treated like a rock star. I think that's the way it should be. Right. This year, the BBF is presented in partnership with GBH, and I am very grateful to have such a distinguished and beloved institution as our partner. Thanks to GBH and to our individual donors, many of whom are here today. Thanks to them, we are able to present this programming free of charge. So now it's my great honor to introduce our nonfiction keynote, Heather Cox Richardson. Heather. Hey, come on. Rock star. Heather, as you know, is a professor of history at Boston College. She's written about the Civil War, Reconstruction, the Gilded Age, and the American West in award-winning books whose subjects stretch from the European settlement of the North American continent to the history of the Republican Party. Her widely read newsletter, Letters from an American, synthesizes history and modern political issues. Heather's latest book is Democracy Awakening, an examination of American history through the lens of authoritarianism. Copies are available for sale and signing immediately after this session. I'm also very pleased to have with us as a moderator Susan Goldberg, the president and CEO of GBH, which... Which I didn't realize is the largest producer of multi-platform content for PBS. Susan came to GBH from National Geographic, where she led the magazine to 11 National Magazine Awards, among other honors. Susan was previously the top editor at my hometown newspaper, the Cleveland Plain Dealer. So a quick housekeeping matter. Heather will sign books for about 30 minutes in order to preserve her wrist. So I think she can, if you don't chat with her too much, I think she can get through a lot of books in 30 minutes. And if you don't get your book signed, we have signed book plates. Thank you, and please join me in welcoming our esteemed guest.
Well, thank you, Heather, for being here today. It's great to see you. You know, this book is coming out at such an incredibly timely moment, right? With an election on the horizon, with the 250th anniversary of the founding of the United States, giving us a moment to really think about our history and to examine it in its fullness. But I want to dive right in with the title of your book, which is Democracy Awakening. And you quote Walt Whitman at the very beginning of the book, and he wrote, "We've frequently printed the word democracy, yet I cannot too often repeat that it's a word the real gist of which sleeps quite unawakened." So has American democracy been asleep this whole time, and why are we awakening now?
So first of all, that is a great way to start, but I want to start by thanking you all for coming and being part of this incredible moment in the United States, and especially to thank the Boston Book Festival and WGBH for doing this, because they're really cool institutions for us to have, are they not? So... No, though. The book is called Democracy Awakening because it certainly feels to me as if our present feels very much like the 1850s. And now I know all of you are like, oh no, we're going for a civil war. And that's not what I mean. What I mean is that in the 1850s, the elite Southern enslavers had taken over the United States political system. They had the presidency, they had the Supreme Court, they had the Senate, and they had made inroads on the House of Representatives. And if you were alive in 1853, it would certainly look to you as if American democracy was over. But people started to wake up. And in 1854, the Southern elite enslavers managed to get through the House of Representatives the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which made it possible for them to spread human enslavement not only across the American South, but also into the American West. And if they did that, the Southern and the Western states would be able to work together to overawe the Northern states in the House of Representatives and be able to make human enslavement national. And they were quite articulate about the fact this is what they intended to do. From there, they were going to spread it globally, and they talked about the fact they had this new perfect system of putting together labor and race so that they would be able to create this new society in which the very wealthy would be able to monopolize the wealth of the people at the bottom. They would get great educations. They would have beautiful paintings on their walls. They would advance human society. And they seem to be able to pull together the United States government to do that. And at that point in 1854, a number of Northerners looked at each other and said, you know, we disagree about immigration, we disagree about finances, we disagree about internal improvements, but by God, we can agree that this nation is about democracy. It's about everybody being equal before the laws. It's not about handing everything over to the rich guys. So by 1856, they had put together a new political party that was organized to stand against that slave power. By 1859, you had this rising Illinois lawyer articulating a new vision for the American government that said it should work for ordinary Americans and not for the very rich. By 1860, they had put him in the White House. By 1863, he had signed the Emancipation Proclamation, making the idea of equality before the law the cornerstone of the United States. And by November of 1863, he had delivered the Gettysburg Address that said that the United States would be founded on the Declaration of Independence and the idea that all men are created equal. In less than 10 years, this country went from we're all going to be have a system of enslavement to we are going to have a system of freedom. And the reason it did that is not because of people like Abraham Lincoln, for all that he was a genius. It was because people woke up.
All right, so do you think that that relates to where we are right now?
110%.
All right, explain why. Why are we, or what is causing us to wake up now?
Well, I think that since, for, and this is, there's a longer story here. This is not just about the present, but I think since the 1980s, people have tended to think that the system of government we had in place, a government that would, you know, regulate business and protect a basic social safety net and promote infrastructure and protect civil rights, was a given. This was the liberal consensus coming out of World War II. People thought it was going to stay. And it got chipped away and chipped away and chipped away, both rhetorically and also by the extremists in the Republican Party taking over what I would consider these nodes of our democracy. And people weren't paying attention. So people ask me, you know, why do you have hope? And I'm like, I am much more hopeful now than I was in 2014. Because it was happening then and no one was paying any attention. And now people are sort of waking up and going, wait a minute, what's this unitary executive? I don't think this is a good idea. Wait a minute, gerrymandering? Why are people getting away with gerrymandering? Oh, wait a minute, what about the electoral, you know? And that idea that people are starting to pay attention and really are paying attention strikes me very much like 1855.
All right, so people, I've read a lot of interviews with you where you do say you're more optimistic now than you've been in a really long time. Is there somebody out there particularly who inspires you? Ah.
And I'm sorry for people who can't see what I just did. I just pointed to the people here, but I mean people all over the country. Certainly we have great leaders. But what really came through to me, and we'll talk about the writing of this book, but what really came through to me in this book was that in terms of people being asleep, American democracy has expanded continuously since the very first moment that the founders who wrote the Declaration of Independence said all men are created equal, having very limited visions of what that meant. And it has done so because people who were not included in that vision, politically marginalized Americans, have continually said, hey, wait a minute, that's a great sentiment. What about me? And as they have done so, we have continued to expand our democracy. And it, again, hey, I could be wrong, But it sure feels to me like we're at a point when we're going to either lose it altogether or expand it once again.
I mean, you've been pretty clear in your comments that you feel like the re-election of Donald Trump to the presidency would end democracy and put us into a different place completely. Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Yes. I believe that if the United States were to elect former President Donald Trump in 2024, or someone like him, we will lose democracy. Not necessarily for all time, strong men always fall, but the question is how long it will take. And I'm not going to speculate on that. I almost said something that I probably would have regretted.
What was it?
It's a journalist, right? The reason I say that is I would say nonpartisan, in that the radical right has been very clear about what it intends to do. And one of the things that concerns me a lot right now is the number of people who sort of say, oh, it's just Trump, let's not bother to pay attention to him. When he suggested that the then chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, had committed treason and suggested that the punishment for treason should be death, or in the past was death, which, just as a note, is not actually terribly accurate in American history, and I can't tell you how much fun it would be to do a deep dive in that, but I won't. That's a big deal. He was literally saying that the man who was in charge of our military, the most powerful military in the world, should be suggested that that person should be put to death because he was not loyal to Donald Trump. That is a game changer by itself. And how many people didn't even see it in the news? I mean, lots of people don't know that even happened. And Milley went on, this is last month as he was stepping down. He actually went on TV and he said, yes, I believe if Donald Trump is reelected, I will be imprisoned. That's not small potatoes. But it's not just that, of course. It's the 2025 Project, the 1,000-page document that outlines what a future president like Donald Trump would do. And central to that is the destruction of our nonpartisan civil service, which we've had since 1883. And what a nonpartisan civil service does is it's the ballast in a boat. You know, the people who are just making sure your paperwork gets through, that, you know, questions are getting answered, they don't really care who's president, they're just doing their jobs, they are the ballast for a democracy. And we have huge numbers of people who do that. You strip that out and make them all loyal to a president, you've lost democracy.
Okay, so I don't mean to be a provocateur here, but you said when we started talking that you didn't think there was going to be another civil war. And it seems even crazy a little bit to even ask a question like this, but given what you've just laid out and the way the country is divided, why are you so sure about that?
Well, I'm not sure about anything. I'm a prophet of the past, not the future. But here's how this moment is different than the past. There are two ways, which I'm actually not signing books, not because I actually do have a bad hand injury, but because I'm so tired that my agent is like, we must get you some sleep. And I know she's sitting in the audience, and when I say I have a number of things, she's always like, I'm really just praying you get through all of them, because I know by the time you get there, you're not going to remember the other ones. So we're only looking for two here. One of the reasons that I'm not concerned about it has to do with the Confederacy and has to do with speed. So if people always think, oh yeah, the 1850s and then the South left. That's all true, but the reason that the South left was because South Carolina was the only state in the Union in 1860 that chose its electors by the legislature. So what that meant is the legislature was sitting during the election, and as soon as Abraham Lincoln was clearly elected, they simply reorganized themselves as a secession convention and took South Carolina out of the Union really, really quickly. Lincoln hadn't even left Illinois yet, let alone become president. With that speed, they then went into Christmas season, because it's November when he's elected. They go into Christmas season, which is not planting season in the South. Everybody's having Christmas balls and dressing up and impressing the ladies and drinking a lot. and saying, we can do this, we can have our own country. And so they roll themselves out of the Union really quickly before Lincoln is ever inaugurated in March of that year. And then, of course, we get the firing on Fort Sumter in April of that year, in part because people are like, ooh, crap, I drank too much over Christmas, and I got to plant my fields, and maybe this wasn't such a good idea. And they recognize that they've got to move really quickly. I think that the Trump administration tried to do that in January of 2017 with the travel ban, which was really threw the country into chaos. You will have forgotten that, I suspect. I found that when I wrote the Trump section of this book, section two, and stripped out all the noise, I was horrified both at what had happened and at how much I had forgotten. Incredibly chaotic. Remember that they put the travel ban while there were already planes in the air so that people arrived in the United States, and all of a sudden their visas didn't mean anything and there were lawyers rushing there. And that, I think, was an attempt to create chaos that could be exploited very quickly. But then especially January 6th. January 6th was the day to make it all happen. And think about, literally it keeps me up at night, if you think about the fact that one of the people that the rioters really wanted to get was Mitt Romney, because he had been the one Republican who had crossed the aisle and voted to convict Donald Trump on one of the articles of impeachment in early 2020. Think of how close he came to being caught. Think about the fact that in that building we had Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker at the time, and Chuck Grassley, head of the Senate at the time, all in that building, Mike Pence. Think about what would have happened if any of them had been taken by that mob. And then think about what any president would have done. How would we have reacted if the president had said they have taken a senator, and God forbid anything else had happened, or the Speaker of the House? And so I am invoking the Insurrection Act. Would you have known what to do? I wouldn't have known what to do. And I think that
but
moment...
But this is not reassuring me that we're not going to have a civil war, actually.
That moment passed, though. That moment passed. They didn't get him. They didn't get any of... The rioters didn't get any of those people. And now we're in the aftermath of that, with more than 1,000 people indicted, a number of people going to prison for really long periods of time, and that person no longer in charge of the military. And that moment, I think, has passed. Now, the second point, Lisa, is that in many ways we already are in a civil war. We're not going to have a period when we have people marching at each other in the streets, but we definitely have low-grade violence that is both political and reinforces some of the elements of the political pressures under which we are currently. And to that, I'm going to point to both racial issues, but domestic violence, which is off the charts, and people do not talk about it. More than 50% of our mass shootings, as they're defined by the FBI, are domestic violence. And so the idea that there's something out there in the future, it's already here. And historians will look at this moment and say, look at the extraordinary gun violence. And how did people not see that that was part of that political moment?
You know, the New York Times had a really interesting story a week or so ago about people voting to leave the places where they grew up just because politically they couldn't stand being there anymore. And they looked at somebody, you know, who'd grown up in Portland, who moved to Missouri, and they looked at somebody, you know, who was coming from the other direction. I mean, it just seems like people are cleaving into almost separate societies.
You know, maybe. Here's where I stand on that. If you look at polls of any hot button issue, abortion, gun safety, immigration, taxes, I'm sure there are more that I can't think of right now, Americans really tend to agree. And by tend to agree, I don't mean 50.1%. I mean 70s, you know, 70% and over, 80% and over of people who want basic gun safety legislation. And I think the issue that we're looking at is the fact that what we as people want is not translating into our representative system, because that representative system has been monopolized by a group of extremists. And, you know, you can see it right now in a micro sense in the House of Representatives and in Congress, where there is a bipartisan majority that wants to increase funding for Ukraine or continue the funding for Ukraine. But, of course, it's not getting on the floor because of a group of 8 people in the House of Representatives. That's crazy. I mean, that's just crazy. No matter what side of that issue you're on, 8 people should not be able to stop our representative system.
So I want to get to that in one second, but you know, in the book, you really don't pull any punches, and you're not here, and you don't in your newsletter. You know, I mean, the book is full of language that compares the actions of Donald Trump to Hitler, and you know, the rise of extremists to the rise of the Nazi powers in the 30s. You know, that is really pretty stark. Does language like that help us have conversations among people who are possibly persuadable or convincible?
So just to be clear, I would say that there's a distinction between saying Donald Trump is Hitler, which is not what I do.
No.
And drawing the parallels in our country to authoritarian movements. And so one of the things that in the writing of the book, it originally began as a series of essays to explain to people what I am asked every day. How do the parties switch sides? What is the Southern strategy? What is liberalism? You know, the things that people, do we live in a democracy or a republic? It started as a series of those essays, very short. The book is 30 chapters, 250 pages. But after I'd written it, while I was writing it, I realized that what people really ask me is, how did we get here? Where here is, are we going to be an authoritarian system or a democracy? And how do we get out? So when I'd figured that out, I wrote these chapters, and then I put them aside and came back to them about 3 months later and discovered that the book was something very different than I thought it had been. It was actually an examination of how people give up a democracy and vote in authoritarians. And when I did that, I recognized that essentially, as far as I'm concerned, there's two ways to look at the world. And coming at this as an Americanist, this may not apply to other countries. I don't know if it does or not, because I don't study other countries. There are those people who believe that we're all created equal, we have a right to be treated equally before the law, and we have a right to have a say in our government. Those are the principles that are outlined in the Declaration of Independence. And there are other people who believe that some people are better than others, and have a right, and maybe a duty, to rule over the rest of us, to amass wealth, to amass power, to tell the rest of us how to live our lives. And one of the points I was trying to make in that book is that, I'm sorry, this book, kind of onto something else, is
too soon. You're still on the book tour.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know. Is that those principles did not start in 1920 with Mussolini and his articulation of fascism. That in fact those principles are deeply embedded in the United States. And one of the points I make is that when Hitler is trying to figure out, I'm sorry, it's not my research that did this, this is somebody else's. When Hitler is trying to figure out how to create racial categories in Germany, what does he look to? He looks to the Jim Crow laws and the Juan Crow laws and the indigenous reservations in the United States. So the idea that somehow it's fascism sprung up in the 1920s, fascism is a very specific ideology that sprung up in the 1920s, and I'm one of those really annoying people who keep saying, we're not really in fascism because it's slightly different when you do, you know, that's what historians do. What my point is that this strand has run through American history since the very beginning. So is that helpful to talk to other people? Well, I don't know if it is or not, because what it really is an attempt to understand this country and to understand that we are not looking just at an individual who sprang out of nowhere in 2015. We're looking at a much longer strand of what's happened in the United States.
I mean, one of the things that I enjoyed about the book, where you zoom through 250 years of history in 253 pages, which is kind of amazing, but the through line really from, you know, some of these very early movements to where we are today through Ruby Ridge and what happened in Waco and what happened at Oklahoma City, you know, with Timothy McVeigh and the bombing of that federal Murrow building, the federal building, and how we've ended up here. So what is that exact through line?
So there, the through line of the book is that the way democracies die is that authoritarians manipulate a population through language, primarily. They find a disaffected population or create a disaffected population, which is what I'm arguing that the Republicans did from 1981 to 2015, that is vulnerable to a strong man who will say, Okay, you know you feel you've been left behind economically or religiously or politically or culturally. The reason for that is because those people, and who those people are doesn't matter, because those people are refusing to follow a series of very specific laws, whether divine or universal, that or traditional, that I alone can put into place. And that once they have done that and begun to draw a group of people toward themselves, those people are in it, invested in that strong man, not necessarily because they think they're going to make his lives better, although they think he's going to make their lives better, although I will point out that Donald Trump was the most moderate Republican on stage in 2016 in terms of economic issues. He called for better health care. He called for infrastructure. He called for bringing manufacturing back. He called for fairer taxes. I mean, he really was offering economic hope as well as the sexism and the racism that he was also selling. But generally, they're not necessarily so concerned about their own well-being. They want to be part of a heroic effort, that this is, they're going to make America great again, or make a country great again, which, by the way, was Reagan talking, who said it at first, not Trump. And once they have bought into this idea of a heroic identity, they don't really care about anything except winning, because they are, for example, going to start a new nation. 1776, you know, that's what all those people were shouting on January 6th of 2021, right? January 1776. So the through line is really how people can destroy a democracy by using that language and by pretending there was a perfect moment in our past, and crucially, how we can change that by understanding our history as one, what I call small d, democratic history, the idea that it's never been perfect. By definition, democratic history is not perfect. It is constantly under construction, and sometimes it moves forward and sometimes it moves back, but the very act of creating it is what makes it possible to make it more inclusive constantly, but also what makes it representative of a democratic society. Small d across the board there.
You know, I've been really interested in how you write about the founders, right? This collection of brilliant young white men who produced an amazing and radical document, but of course they were deeply flawed in so many ways, right? Many of them were enslavers, they never mentioned women, you know, Native Americans are savages, their whole view of the world. I'm curious, as a historian, what do you think about the conversations that we're having around the country to take down statues of some of these people or rename the buildings that you know, the Thomas Jefferson High School type thing?
So this, of course, a fraught issue in American history. And my take on this, first of all, is that statues to the U.S. Confederacy do not belong on any federal property under any circumstances. But there's a difference in terms, in memory, between commemoration and history. And one of the things that, and I always like to pick on Amelia Earhart on this, because people don't tend to have strong feelings about Amelia Earhart. We don't have statues of Amelia Earhart up because of who she was as a person. Very complicated person. We're all complicated people, because humans got a human, right? At different times, we honor people for different things. And that is a different thing than saying we have to embrace everything that is in somebody's past. Because if we do that, none of us gets a statue, right? And one of the great examples of this, aside from her, is the $20 bill, which has Andrew Jackson on it. Nowadays, many of us find that really offensive, because Andrew Jackson, just don't even start me, right? But he got there in the 1930s. They put him on the 20 because he represented an ordinary American. He was an elite enslaver who just, like I say, don't start me. But he represented a man who stood against the bankers who were trying, and he was trying to make government respond to ordinary Americans. So in that period, he was the right person to have on that 20. One of the things that I like, though, is the idea that we change who we honor and for what reasons we honor them. And the idea that because somebody put it up 100 years ago means we need to keep it just strikes me as some being about something very different than being about who those people actually are. So my take on the Confederacy is different than my take on statues. I think it's a real problem that we don't have more statues that commemorate more recent people, people of color, women, people that young children can see themselves in. And I have no problem taking down some of these many statues we have and replacing them. That being said, just because we're in Boston, do you notice that we have a gazillion statues to the founders and the revolutionary people out, especially in public places? Do you know why that is? I'm so into trivia. It's because in the late 19th century, the Republican Party was in charge of Congress, and it wanted high tariffs because it was protecting business and enabling businessmen to essentially collude to raise prices. It's the era of the trusts and all that. But because the tariffs were so high, the government was running a really big surplus. So they were trying to find ways to spend that money that was not offensive. So we got a lot of courthouses, we got a lot of really nice customs houses, and we got a lot of statues, but this is the 1890s, and you sure weren't going to put them up of people who had been running around during the Civil War era. So what could everybody agree on? Statues of people from the Revolutionary era, and that's why we have so many statues of the Revolutionary era, especially here in Boston, but all over the country. Kind of cool.
Thank you for that. I had no idea. I want to switch gears and talk a little bit about you and your process and how you ended up here on this stage. I mean, what I've read that you hated history. That you hated school.
Hated school.
You hated
I loved
school.
History.
But what was it about history that was interesting to you?
So I just want to say something about the school hating thing. I still hate school.
But wait a minute, you're a college professor.
I'm a college professor.
Okay.
And I actually think that's an advantage, because I always recognize that people have other and perhaps better things to do than listening to me. So I try and make sure it's worthwhile. And I think students appreciate that. That's like, if you listen to my videos, like, I don't chat when they start. I'm like, let's get to this, because I don't have, you know, I know you got to go make dinner or whatever. And I think hating school actually probably makes me a better teacher. It was my math teacher who taught me that.
But why did you hate school? Was it boring?
It seemed like a huge waste of time when you could just go to the library and do it yourself. Like, you know, honest to God, I was in graduate school before I recognized that lectures in college were actually mandatory, and you were supposed to go and learn stuff. And I was teaching for my advisor, David Donald, and we were all sitting around, we wrote the exam, and I said, but this is a crappy exam. If you came to class, you know the answers. And they were like, that's the point. I'm like, but weren't they supposed to be in the library learning new stuff? And they're like, no, they were supposed to be coming to class. And I'm like, note to self, go to class. So I didn't like history. I didn't like college. I always loved history. Okay. And I always loved mythology, because they are essentially explorations of the human mind and the patterns we see. And history is the story of how we explain ourselves. We are in many ways, I think, again, not a veterinarian, but one of the only species that defines ourselves by understanding the passage of time. And I understand dogs do it by scent, but I mean by understanding and shaping our world by the way we understand who we are. We are, after all, the collection of our memories. So what we put in those memories and the patterns in which we put them say everything about human society. So I've told the story of how I fell in love with history, but it had always been part of my life growing up. We didn't have, I mean, we had TV, but, you know, everything, there were three channels and it was a snowstorm.
I was going to say, there wasn't a lot on, right?
No, not in Maine, let me tell you. So we would sit and we would listen to stories, and we would listen to storytellers. And I just got to say, people say I'm a good storyteller, and I am not being modest when I say, if you'd heard these old guys, I mean, we would just sit and listen to them for hours in a room. And I wouldn't, if we were in a room of them, of 10, of 20 of them, I wouldn't even make the cut. They were the worlds that they brought to life. And you had to understand that they would each tell the same story completely differently, which was actually great training for going into history.
Well, and as as a journalist, and I think history is incredibly important to bring into, you know, current stories to help people really understand the context, but are there things that journalists and journalism should learn from how we tell history that, you know, that should be incorporated to make those stories richer, deeper, better?
I'm really glad you asked that, because there is, I want to say, people rag a lot on journalists, and I do sometimes too privately. It's a really hard profession, as you know. It's a dangerous profession. It takes not only the writing skill, but also the people skills to get the stories and to make the connections. But journalists and historians are very different, and people call me a journalist, and I am not one. I do not have those skills to go out and, you know, get the sources and do all that legwork that journalists do. What journalists do is they find the story. They tell you what happened. What historians do, and we're very well trained, by the way, in this, is to tell you why the story matters, how it fits into a larger pattern, and what that says about how societies change. That's what historians do. We study how societies change. And we work together. It is not simply a question. I know a number of journalists who write history, but they do it with this happened, this happened, this happened. And that's not, even if you're putting the pieces down, that's not telling you why it matters. They're really different professions, and it's really good to work together. But I'm not, all I would say in terms of journalists today is that it's a problem, I think, that there has been such pressure since 1986 and the fall of the, seven, whichever it was, and the fall of the Fairness Doctrine, which was probably going to go anyway, by the way, but under Ronald Reagan, this pressure to say that everything is about what one person says and what another person says. You know, J. Rosen, who studies media, calls the horse race and not the stakes, is a real problem, because you need to have the background that says, hey, wait a minute, do you remember 2 years ago when somebody did X? That's how this is playing out. And we don't get that. And so often, one of the reasons I write is that I'll read the news and I'll think, what the hell just happened? And I'll have to do some research to say, oh, wait a minute, I remember this happened, and this makes it a longer story. That we could see more of, but I think it's a mistake to demand that our journalists understand the theories behind how different societies work. That is a lifetime study. I mean, there's a reason I have a doctorate.
I mean, I think you'd be a good journalist, actually. But and you're really good at writing on deadline. You know, you write a...
See, I think that's fun. Did you like writing on deadline?
Oh, more than anything. Yes. Otherwise, nothing happens. I need that deadline.
It's like, it's fun. It's. I mean, I just heard the heads exploding. But it's kind of like a challenge. I mean, lots of you guys probably do that, those games on the New York Times, Wordle and Artle and whatever they are. But this is my fun place. Like, okay, can I write 1,200 words on Niger? Let's see. You know?
So do you have a favorite place that you write? I mean, you know,
any
now that we can...
Any place where there is noise.
Oh, wait, explain more.
I need activity. I need... The pandemic almost killed me. Because, you know, even with the radio on and, you know, I couldn't be in public. I write in malls.
Oh. You just take your laptop and...
Mm-hmm. Anywhere that there's people. Because it creates like a buzz. I can't have somebody talking to me, but yeah, anywhere, because, I don't know, I just like writing in unusual places. And people are always like, I'll get you some private, quiet space. I'm like, just shoot me now, because I'd really rather go sit.
See, you totally elsewhere. Could have been a journalist. The newsrooms of the past were really noisy places.
That would be great.
Yeah,
that would be
okay.
My happy place.
All right, we are going to invite our audience in to join this conversation. We've got a microphone... Somebody with a microphone. Yes, we've got somebody with a microphone. I'm going to ask and beg, please don't, like, make a speech. Just a really short question. So, hands up if you've got a question for Heather, and we've got a microphone here. How about right over there? We had a hand right there. Yes, him.
I'm told that by someone who heard you last week in Washington, D.C., that we all need to ask you to tell us your thoughts on the story about the Confederate flag at the Capitol on January 6th.
Was Please. That recorded? I think that was that recorded?
Was what?
My agent says that that was recorded. I will tell it if you would like me to. Maybe we should do... Oh, this is so great. I missed the classroom. Let's have a show of hands. Who would like to hear that story?
Well...
Okay, so it's not the majority of you, so...
But it's a lot, and you wrote in the book, actually, about how it was the first time on January 6th when that guy carried the Confederate battle flag into the Capitol. He accomplished something that they couldn't do in the 1860s, and now you can finish the sentence.
Okay, so I think what they are looking for is that moment. So January 6th, I'm in Maine. And I live on the end of a dirt road that you can't even turn around at the end of. And Buddy was at work. And a student called me and said, turn on your TV right now. And I'm telling this part, which I didn't tell in Washington, because it's so typical of me. I don't know how to turn our TV on. So I'm like, and it's one of those, there's all these remotes and stuff. So I said to Steve, I said, I got to call you back because I don't know how to turn the TV on. And he is a student of mine for many years. And he's like, he had a very choice expletive for that. So I learned how to turn the TV on. And Steve and I, he's a police officer and a teacher here in the Boston area. And we stayed on the phone together all day watching this. And, you know, I don't know about you, I was in horror. I couldn't believe it. And he's a police officer, and he kept screaming, where's the backup? Where's the backup? Where's the backup? There should be backup. This is how long it takes to get backup. Where's the backup? It was a hell of a day. But anyway, for me, seeing the Confederate flag go into the U.S. Capitol was probably, I won't say it was the worst moment of my life, but it was right up there. And the reason for that is because my first book was on the Civil War, and during the Civil War, there was a woman from here in Boston named Julia Ward Howe, and she went to Boston, and she was really upset in many ways. She was in an abusive marriage, and her husband was too old to fight, and all of her friends were sending their husbands and their sons to war, and she couldn't do that because he was too old and her children were too young for her to do things like work in the hospitals and all that. She had very small children. And they went out one day to see the troops that were ringing the Capitol building because there was great concern that the Confederate troops would pour into Washington, which is of course surrounded by slave areas. And as they were in this carriage, one of her friends, they were listening, and they heard Union soldiers singing a very popular ditty about hanging Jefferson Davis from a sour apple tree. And they were very religious, and her friend said, you should write something better than that. Because she was a poet and she was a writer and a philosopher, actually. And she went home that night and went to bed and woke up in the middle of the night, and a poem had come to her, and she got up out of bed and didn't turn the gas up because her children were in bed with her and she would wake them up. And so she wrote down on an envelope the words to the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. But then in the next verse, she wrote, I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps. And what she meant was she was looking out the window and seeing the camps of the men that were in tents around Washington, had left their homes here in Massachusetts and elsewhere to go and protect the U.S. Capitol. And they had done that for 4 years. 600,000 people had died. Almost $6 billion worth of treasure had gone into protecting that capital. But they had done it. And ever since then, that idea of destroying the U.S. government had never again threatened the capital. So when that, and I've used choice language about this man, that person brought the Confederate flag into the Capitol. To me, it was not just about that moment. It was about those 600,000 men and the other million who worked in the Navy and in the Army to protect the U.S. Capitol. It was about everybody who since then has worked to protect the United States government. And the fact that anybody would try to tear that down and be supported not only by the president, but by members of Congress, was so profoundly offensive to me that I plan to spend the rest of my life making sure it never happens again.
Thank you for asking that question. Do we have other questions? We've got a hand way in the back, straight right there. And let's wait for, no, we need a microphone to you. We'll get one to you.
First, I wanted to say as one teacher to another, valid not liking school. I've been through that too. And secondly, the question I had was, when you're looking at the current events and what's happening, what's your process in terms of like finding the threads to where we've been, how we got there? Like, are there specific ones that jump out? Is it whatever you're thinking about on a particular day?
That's a really cool question, because the news comes at you like a fire hose, and I don't look for themes at all. What I look for is what a historian, a graduate student in 150 years is gonna wanna know about this particular day. So if you notice last night, last night was very late, I wrote, there are bigger stories that I'll talk about in the future. And the reason I did that was partly a signal to my readers, but partly a signal to her that more happened on this day than I had the wherewithal to cover. And so what I have found, and of course my focus is on the United States, and my focus is on our government in whatever things that means. So there's other stuff I'm interested in that rarely makes it anywhere into the letters. My master's is in literature, but you would never know it, right? Except when occasionally I throw in Uncle Tom's Cabin. But what I have found, weirdly, is that because of what I'm interested in and because of who the players are, they often reappear. And then you end up, if you read through the letters as a whole, which I've never done, but I've read chunks of them for various projects, you find that there are themes. And it's interesting because it reminds me of some of the very famous Civil War diaries we have, like Mary Chestnut's Civil War Diary, which is a diary of her life during the Confederacy. And she went to rewrite it as a novel because it turned out that there were a number of the same stories that just kept coming and coming and coming. So maybe it is that we live in a period in which there is, if you will, a zeitgeist that I am capturing without being aware of it. Even in, for example, the fact that it's bothering me an enormous amount. Anybody who's talked to me in the last 2 days knows that I'm very bothered by the fact I have not written about the fact that the U.S. government on October 10th recognized Niger as having undergone a military coup. That strikes me as being incredibly important. But why does an Americanist in this moment think that's so important? That's something that future historians will also look at and say, wait a minute, why is she concerned about Niger and Azerbaijan in a way that she probably wouldn't have been in 1985? And so that's how I pick stuff out. And you can see when there's something unusual that happens, I think.
Great. Time for one more question. And we've got right here in the front.
First of all, as Maine goes, so goes the rest of the nation.
You want me to tell the story behind that? Sorry, go ahead.
Probably. 8 people are holding up our government right now. How do we do something about that?
Okay, this is a great question and a lovely note to end on. But I can't resist.
The main story?
The main story. The reason that we have that expression, as Maine goes, so goes the nation, is because Maine voted before anybody else in the nation in its local and state elections. So if you got a leg up in those, it tended to bleed over into the national elections. So you really wanted to try to stack things in Maine so that you would be able to get that momentum going when you went national. And the reason that Abraham Lincoln chooses Hannibal Hamlin to be on his vice presidential ticket in 1860 is because Hannibal Hamlin is from Maine, and Hannibal Hamlin is incredibly well connected because his father built the house that the Washburn brothers lived in, and the Washburn brothers were in political office in Maine, Wisconsin, Illinois. Those three. There's one that's going to be added from Minnesota later. So that was a really good way to, and they had also grown up with Owen Lovejoy and Elijah P. Lovejoy, the guy who gets killed in Alton, Illinois in 1837. And so he's got connections. And the reason I love that story is because Buddy and I agreed on that at our first date. He said, "You're the only person I've ever known who knows who Hannibal Hamlin is." And I'm like, "Funny, you're the only person I've ever known who knows who Hannibal Hamlin is."
And it was love at first sight.
It was love before that, but yeah, that's why we kept dating. Anyway, so that's why we have that saying, and of course it's not still the case, but we in Maine like to say it is. The thing that we should do, and that people always say to me, what can I do? There's only one of me. And I always say the usual. Vote, run for office, give money, all those things that you already know about. But I am an idealist, and by that I don't mean that I can hunt ducks with a rake. I mean that I believe ideas change society. And the way you change ideas is you change the public conversation. And that means that you talk about the fact that there are eight people stopping everything, and you don't like that. Even if you might like some of the ideas or not, that is not a democratic system. And you talk about it with your friends, we know, and you get people to vote. We know that relational organizing is way more effective than any other kind of organizing. Making sure that your friends actually show up to vote, and you talk about the things that are important to you, and you make sure your legislators hear that. So somebody says to me, "I live in Ron Johnson's district. He's never going to want to do what I say." And I'm like, that's absolutely correct. Ron Johnson is not going to live forever, and there are young people coming up wanting to go into office who are going to be listening to what the voters want. And if you don't believe me, look at the fact that Clarence Thomas just recused himself from sitting on a case having to do with the January 6th insurrection. Even more strongly, look at the fact that after the overturning of Roe versus Wade in June of 2022, Republican state officers were bragging about the fact they overturned it with the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health decision. They were bragging about these draconian anti-choice laws that they were putting into place. When Democrats started overperforming in special elections by 8 points, usually in elections won with less than a point, by 8 points, they backed way off. And now they're starting to use language that isn't anti-abortion language. They're trying to rebrand themselves as not being anti-abortion. Don't be fooled by that, by the way. But they're backing off on that because they know it's a non-starter. So if that matters that much over choice legislation, reproductive health, imagine what it would do for gun safety legislation. Imagine it would do for what it would do for some of these other issues in which, as I say, we are the vast majority of us are agreed. More than 80% of Americans want basic gun safety legislation. So don't think you're in a minority just because other people are yelling more loudly. Two people in one state were responsible for most of the challenges to books that have been taken off shelves in schools and libraries. Two, not 200, not 2,000, not 20,000, not 200,000, two. Here in this room, we could have shut that up in a hurry. So make your voices heard. There's a lot more of those of us who believe in democracy than those of us who don't. And the trick is going to be in the next 14 months to make sure that that is the direction of the country. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, it's so long as you believe in democracy, you're part of this team. And, you know, we can hash out the rest of the stuff afterward. But until 2024, that's what it's going to have to be. And that's what we should all be doing in addition to all the other stuff. Well,
Heather Cox Richardson, with those inspiring words, that is where we are going to leave it. I want to thank everybody, and if you could just stay in your seat for 1 second so we can escort Heather off so she can sign those books. Much appreciated. Thanks for being such a great audience.
Thank you all for everything you're doing.